Well, the title of my paper is Holding the Rope, Andrew Fuller and William Carey. Biographies of William Carey invariably refer to an incident that occurred early in Carey's ministry in England. At a meeting of the Northamptonshire Baptist Association, Carey proposed that the pastors discuss whether the command given to the apostles to teach all the nations was not binding on all succeeding ministers to the end of the world, seeing that the accompanying promise was of equal extent. The question was, of course, brilliantly worded, contained the unavoidable answer in its premise. Coming from a ragged shoemaker, it might have seemed cheeky to some of the senior pastors. John Collett Ryland's response is well known. He said, "Young man, sit down. When God pleases to convert the heathen, he will do it without your aid or mine." John Ryland Jr. later denied that his father had actually said this. However, given the well-documented propensity of his father to make bombastic statements, it's probable that Ryland Sr. Said at least something of the sort. While this anecdote may be revealing of the senior John Ryland's personality and provide a glimpse of the hyper-Calvinism that had affected Baptist life for many years, taken in isolation, which often happens in the biographies and literature on Carey, taken in isolation, it gives a distorted view of the reception of Carey's missionary vision received in the Northampton, his missionary vision received in the Northamptonshire Association. Another anecdote from this period helps balance the picture. Carey's biographer Samuel Pierce Carey passed on a description of another association meeting. His description goes like this. He said, "Carey had preached, and there came pushing his way to him a man of 33, robust and broad-shouldered, with the lines of thought cut sharply in his face, but with an almost feminine tenderness trembling in the eyes under the shadow of the dark eyebrows. Seizing the hand of the preacher who had given utterance to the sentiments which had for some time been struggling for room in his own heart, he said, 'We must know more of each other.'" The robust, broad-shouldered man, of course, was Andrew Fuller. His physique contrasted sharply with that of Carey, who was short and prematurely bald, but they soon discovered that their hearts beat to the same tune. C.S. Lewis has written that friendship is born at that moment when one person says to another, "What, you two? I thought I was the only one." Now, William Carey and Andrew Fuller were drawn together by the same expansive gospel vision, and their friendship would mark a turning point in the history not just of the Baptist denomination, but of world Christianity. It takes nothing from Carey, as father of the modern missionary movement, to say that the formation of the particular Baptist Missionary Society and the later Serampore Mission was the product of inspired teamwork. Carey's efforts in India were made exponentially more effective by the synergism of the Serampore trio formed by his partnership with Joshua Marshman and William Ward. Their efforts were augmented by those of Hannah Marshman, the very prototype of the missionary wife, and by many others, both European and Indian. The Serampore trio was mirrored in England by what might be called the society trio of Andrew Fuller, John Ryland, and John Sutcliffe. As with the Serampore trio, fairness requires the mention of Samuel Pierce and numerous other supporters in Scotland and America. However, the story begins with Carey and Fuller. The birth of the modern missionary movement cannot be understood apart from their friendship. Andrew Fuller's reaction to the proposal that the Northamptonshire pastors discuss whether the Great Commission was still binding differed from that of John Ryland Sr. In his memoirs of the life and writings of the Reverend Andrew Fuller, Morris comments that the mission to India was at first generally regarded as chimerical. Fuller himself stated that some of our ministers considered the plan to be like a proposal to make a turnpike road to the moon. Fuller also acknowledged, he had said in effect, "If the Lord should make windows in heaven, might this thing be?" While this reaction can still be construed as negative, it was different than Ryland's. Rather than a denial of the propriety of the idea, it was a recognition of its epic scale. While Fuller would play a critical role in the future of the Baptist Missionary Society, there's no doubt that the original idea came from Carey. Fuller himself wrote, "The origin of the society will be found in our brother Carey's mind, which for the last 9 or 10 years has been directed to this object with very little intermission. His heart appears to have been set upon the conversion of the heathen before he came to reside at Moulton in 1786. While the missionary vision originated with Carey, it would not have been fulfilled without Fuller's self-sacrificing service. Since the founding of the Baptist Missionary Society, the role of home support in missions has been referred to as holding the rope. The image is that of a missionary who descends into a deep mine to retrieve the riches. Home supporters accept the role of holding the rope that sustains the missionary. The analogy has often been attributed to Carey, but it actually belongs to Fuller. In a letter to Christopher Anderson, Fuller wrote, "Our undertaking to India really appeared at its beginning to me somewhat like a few men who were deliberating about the importance of penetrating a deep mine which had never before been explored. We had no one to guide us, and whilst we were thus deliberating, Carey, as it were, said, 'Well, I will go down if you will hold the rope.' But before he descended, he, as it seemed to me, took an oath from each of us at the mouth of the pit to this effect, that while we lived, we should never let go the rope." A Fuller supporting role can be analyzed under three headings. First, he was instrumental in laying the groundwork for a reformed theology of mission. Second, as the secretary of the Baptist Missionary Society, he carried a great administrative burden until the time of his death. And third, he was a courageous defender of the missionary cause. So, a theology of mission. The modern missionary movement actually began as a revival among the pastors of the Northamptonshire Baptist Association. Concerned over the declining health of the churches of their denomination, they met for fellowship, prayer, and theological discussion. Spurred on by an appreciation for the theology of Jonathan Edwards, they brought renewal to their churches and took up village preaching to spread the gospel to unreached areas in the English Midlands. The key figures of this revival, Fuller, Ryland, Sutcliffe, and Pierce, would become the leaders of the Baptist Missionary Society. Among these men, Fuller stood out. He was a passionate evangelist, pastor, and defender of the faith. His concern for the health of the churches led him to pen polemical works exposing the errors of Sandemanianism and Socinianism. Perhaps Fuller's most influential work, The Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation, was written to counter the extremes of hyper-Calvinism. In this work, he developed the idea of duty faith, the doctrine that the unconverted are required to heed the gospel call. As Calvinist, Fuller and his friends understood the implications of man's depravity and inability, but following Jonathan Edwards' distinction between moral and natural ability, they asserted that sinners were duty-bound to respond to the gospel and preachers were duty-bound to offer it freely. The work of an older associate of the Northamptonshire pastors, Robert Hall, had written a book. His book was Help for Zion's Weary Travelers. Dealt with many of the same themes as Fuller's book, and it helped William Carey in his own spiritual struggles. Carey also came under the influence of Edwards, like the other Northamptonshire pastors. He was especially moved by Edwards' publication of David Brainerd's Missionary Journal. As a young pastor, Carey entered fully into the spirit of the Northamptonshire Association and saw growth in the churches that he pastored in Moulton and later in Leicester. The creative approach to evangelism and the emphasis on village preaching that developed in the Northamptonshire Association were taken up by Carey as basic practices once he was established in India. Like Ryan mentioned, they had an enormous circuit that they covered on a regular basis. And Paul Brewster provides an example of how Fuller's evangelistic burden led him to adopt innovative approaches. Concern for the young women employed in Kettering's lace industry, Fuller had evangelistic hymns printed on the papers used to wrap the thread they purchased. This same missionary mindset can be seen in Carey's ministry on the field. He looked for strategic cultural junctures at which the gospel could be delivered. For example, Carey and his Serampore partners developed the practice of singing gospel hymns in imitation of traditional Hindu ballad singers who would sing at important crossroads. They would do this to draw a crowd for preaching. Carey's contribution was to extend the logic of the Northamptonshire Revival to foreign missions. His unique preoccupation produced his well-known dedication to the acquisition of biblical languages and biblical and foreign languages. His concern for the spiritual state of the peoples of the world is perhaps best represented by the large annotated map he made of leather and hung on the wall of his Moulton workshop. While Carey was dependent on the theology of Fuller and the other Northamptonshire Association Baptists, he went beyond them in his appeal for a worldwide effort. His brethren, however, followed soon enough. This is illustrated by an incident that took place before Carey published his great missionary tract, The Inquiry. Carey had the chance to make the case for missions to Thomas Potts, a prosperous Baptist businessman from Birmingham. Potts offered to fund the printing of what would become The Inquiry. Carey was reluctant to take such a leading role and appealed to Sutcliffe, Fuller, and Ryland to do the writing. They, however, insisted Carey take up the pen. And beyond providing an example of Carey's characteristic reticence, this indicates the likelihood that by this point, Fuller and the other younger pastors of the association were in essential agreement with Carey's point of view before The Inquiry was ever published. Fuller probably played a direct role in shaping Carey's missionary theology. While it is difficult to determine the degree of direct influence, at minimum, he provided valuable feedback. Brian Stanley and Peter Morden have drawn attention to the apparent interdependence of the missiological formulations of Fuller and Carey in the days before the actual founding of the particular Baptist Missionary Society. There is a notable coincidence between language used by Carey in The Inquiry and a message preached by Fuller at an association meeting held at Clipstone in April of 1791. Fuller's message was titled "The Pernicious Influence of Delay in Religious Matters," and many of the key points of Carey's inquiry are touched upon briefly in the message. Fuller mentions, for example, previous noble efforts, though he considered them small in number when compared with the magnitude of the object. He refers to the motivation for mission provided by the value of human souls, and mentions the providential openings provided by the improvement of navigation, the maritime and commercial turn of this country. He also made a strong statement about the responsibility to employ means in world evangelism. This is his statement. "We pray for the conversion and salvation of the world and yet neglect the ordinary means by which those ends have been used to be accomplished. It pleased God heretofore by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believed. And there's reason to think it will still please God to work by the distinguished means. Ought we not then at least to try by some means to convey more of the good news of salvation to the world around us than hitherto has been conveyed? The encouragement to the heathen is still in force. Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. But how shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach except they be sent?" And this idea is at the very heart of Carey's inquiry. Morden points out that in his Clipston message, Fuller stopped just short of stating that the Great Commission was binding on believers in every age. His message strongly implied this idea, but the explicit statement was left to Carey in The Inquiry, which was published in May of 1792. It is difficult from this distance to trace the details of the mutual influence of Carey and Fuller. Doubtless, many ideas developed in parallel as they were discussed. As we have seen, Fuller gave Carey the credit for the original idea to found a missionary society. All of the major accounts also point to independent sources for Carey's original impulse, such as the journals of Captain Cook, which contained the account of the experience of the Endeavour's crew amongst the inhabitants of Tahiti. Regarding the interdependence of Carey's inquiry and Fuller's message at Clipstone, Though the inquiry post-dates the Clipstone message, Morden writes that Carey was drawing from Fuller's Clipstone sermon is, in fact, by no means certain. It is possible that Fuller had borrowed from Carey rather than vice versa, given that Fuller had seen and critiqued an early manuscript of the inquiry before he preached at Clipstone. Morden concludes that the inquiry is very much Carey's own work, even if he may have drawn on Fuller's sermon. Whatever the degree of literary relationship between the dangers of pernicious delay and the inquiry, Fuller's theology was the bedrock on which Carey's missiology was built. In the inquiry, Carey did not deal directly with the arguments over the free offer of the gospel which had occupied his denomination during previous years. He simply argued for carrying the gospel to foreign lands. However, he clearly implied that his mission's thinking presupposed the foundation laid by Fuller and the other pastors of the Northamptonshire Association. For example, in section 5 of the inquiry, he developed the idea that prayer is critical for preparing the way for missionary endeavors. He provided as a concrete example the recent experience of the Northamptonshire Association. Carey wrote, "With reference to our own immediate connections, we have within these few years been favored with some tokens for good granted in answer to prayer, which should encourage us to persist and increase in that important duty. I trust our monthly prayer meetings for the success of the gospel have not been in vain. It is true a want of importunity too generally attends our prayers, yet unimportunate and feeble as they may have been, it is to believe that God has heard and in a measure answered them." As evidence that God had begun to answer their prayers, he offered four facts. The churches that have engaged in the practice have in general since that time been evidently on the increase. Second, some controversies which have long perplexed and divided the church are more clearly stated than ever. And then he added two more, that there are calls to preach the gospel in many places where it had yet to be preached, and that the spread of civil liberties and the growing opposition to the slave trade meant that there were many open doors. The first two points, and perhaps the third, were primarily references to Carey's own association and the recent history in that association. So while the reference was somewhat oblique, the second point regarding the resolution of certain theological controversies surely referred to the theological changes that Fuller had promoted with his writings. Carey referred to the controversies in the plural, so something more than the question of duty, faith, and the free offer of the gospel may have been meant, and perhaps he had in mind Fuller's engagement with Socinianism, a nemesis that would come back to haunt the mission at Serampore in later years. Another oblique reference to the former controversies is found in the inquiry, where Carey refuted the idea that it is wrong to preach to the heathen. He maintained that there are very few reasons to support such a view, one of which was the idea that the secret purpose of God is the rule of our duty, in which case, Carey responds, it must be as bad to pray for them as to preach to them. Now, this statement extended the logic of the earlier arguments against hyper-Calvinism, and Carey's rebuttal provides a characteristic sample of the sharp pithiness Carey would unsheath when aroused to defend the truth. To a great degree, the thinking of both Carey and Fuller continued on parallel tracks as long as Fuller lived. Now, this is illustrated by the development of Fuller's thinking on the use of means in missions. As we have seen, the importance of grasping means was a core idea in Carey's inquiry. The full title is, of course, An Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathens. Carey would write, "As our blessed Lord has required us to pray for that his kingdom may come and his will be done on earth as it is in heaven, it becomes us not only to express our desires of that event by words, but by the use of every lawful method to spread the knowledge of his name." Carey linked the use of means to the ministry of the apostles after the resurrection of Christ. He wrote, "When he had laid down his life and taken it up again, he sent forth his disciples to preach the good tidings to every creature and to endeavor by all possible means to bring over a lost world to God. While he did not elaborate at this point on the means used by the apostles, it is clear that he feels the use of means is biblically warranted. The use of the word possible implies a standard of practicality. The perfect tool is not always available, but the perfect should not be made the enemy of the good. In the inquiry, Carey would also link the use of means with the doctrine of providence. He saw the hand of God in the development of certain technologies and believed that their existence increased the weight of the missionary command. In answering the potential objections to the missionary, in answering potential objections to the missionary enterprise, he wrote, "First, as to their distance from us, whatever objections might have been made on that account before the invention of the mariner's compass, nothing can be alleged for it with any color of plausibility in the present age. Men can now sail with as much certainty through the great South Sea as they can through the Mediterranean or any lesser sea. Yea, and providence seems in a manner to invite us to the trial, as there are, to our knowledge, trading companies whose commerce lies in many of the places where these barbarians dwell." Excuse me. Fuller had spoken in similar terms at Clipstone. Fuller had said, "We have opportunities in abundance. The improvement of navigation and the maritime and commercial turn of this country furnish us with these, and it deserves to be considered whether this is not a circumstance that renders it a duty peculiarly binding on us. The truth is, if I am not mistaken, we wait for we know not what." Carey would present a draft of his inquiry after the Clipstone meeting when the association gathered at Leicester. Fuller's sermon had resonated with the same urgency that came through in Carey's tract. The following is from Fuller, though it is almost indistinguishable from Carey. "We pray for the conversion and salvation of the world and yet neglect the ordinary means by which those ends have been used to be accomplished. It pleased God heretofore by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believed, and there is reason to believe it will still please God to work by that distinguished means. Ought we not then at least to try by some means to convey more of the good news of salvation to the world around us than hitherto has been conveyed? The encouragement of the heathen is still in force. Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved." It is not possible to trace which of the two men first saw the issue of the use of means in this light. Perhaps even they would not have been sure. What is clear that the same spirit was working in both hearts, and over the years, Fuller would continue to meditate on the matter. Not quite 10 years later, Fuller spoke at the annual meeting of the Bedford Union. In a sermon titled "God's Approbation Necessary for Success," he drew principles from the story of the conquest of the Promised Land in the Old Testament. If God means to save any of them, it seems he must bring them under the gospel or the gospel in some miraculous manner to them, whereas the command of the Savior is that we go and preach to every creature. All that Israel gained was by the dint of the sword. Here again we hear echoes of Carey's inquiry. Like Carey, Fuller attacked the notion that obedience must depend on previous miraculous intervention. The command stands, and obedience requires the grasping of the means at hand, represented in this case by the sword taken up by the Israelites. Fuller apparently continued to think on the use of means in the history of God's working with Israel, because in December of 1814, he returned to the subject in an address delivered to the British and Foreign School Society in London. "If it be the design of God to diffuse the knowledge of himself over the earth in these last days, it might be expected that suitable means and instruments would be employed to accomplish it. When he meant to rear a tabernacle in the wilderness, he raised up Bezalel and Aholiab and otherwise hearted men, in whom he put wisdom and understanding. Thus, we might expect men to be gifted and qualified for the work appointed them, and to be stirred up to engage in it. It might be expected, supposing a great work designed to be accomplished, that societies would be formed, some to translate the sacred scriptures into the languages of the nations, some to give them circulation, some to scatter tracts which shall impress their leading principles, some to preach the gospel, and some to teach the rising generation to read and write. Fuller saw no contradiction between divine activity and human agency. The two artisans commissioned to construct the tabernacle were taken as examples of the manner in which men and their abilities are used by God to fulfill His purposes. At this stage, Fuller had expanded the range of lawful means to include translation, publication, and education. This went beyond Carey's suggestion in the inquiry that a society be formed, but it reflected the developments on the field at this point in 1814. There is some evidence of the development in Fuller's views on the matter of the use of means, but his thinking continued to run parallel with Carey's. However, at this later stage, Carey's ideas were primarily expressed in concrete endeavors on the field. In Fuller's case, while there may have been development over time, the basic idea was clear to him from the earliest years of his ministry. In the life and death of Andrew Fuller, John Ryland included Fuller's extensive doctrinal confession from the time he moved from Soham to the pastorate at Kettering. In Article 15 contains his strong views on the free offer of the gospel, which reads like this: "I believe it is the duty of every minister of Christ plainly and faithfully to preach the gospel to all who will hear it. And as I believe the inability of men to spiritual things to be wholly of the moral and therefore of the criminal kind, and that it is their duty to love the Lord Jesus Christ and trust in Him for salvation, though they do not, I therefore believe free and solemn addresses, invitations, calls, and warnings to them to be not only consistent but directly adapted as means in the hand of the Spirit of God to bring them to Christ. I consider it as a part of my duty which I would not omit without being guilty of the blood of souls." I really think that this paragraph deserves serious study. Right, while probably unintentional, the paragraph can be seen as a chiasm with the use of means at its cores. At its core, you have the minister's duty to preach, then you have man's moral inability, and at the heart you have the idea of the use of means. You come back to the idea of the Spirit's enabling, which balances out man's moral inability. And again, he closes the final statement as a statement about the minister's duty to preach. This concise statement could be taken as the very theological seed that produced the modern missionary movement, and its eloquence should not be quickly passed over. Society administration and fundraising. The particular Baptist Missionary Society would have never been born without the leadership of Andrew Fuller. Carey was the society's progenitor, but Fuller was the midwife that brought it into the world. The story has often been told of the Nottingham meeting of the Northampton Association in May of 1792, when Carey spoke from Isaiah 54 and verses 2 and 3. This message became known as the Deathless Sermon and gave us the watchwords: expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. There's some debate if that's the actual form. The debate's interesting, but I'm not sure it's that important. In spite of the power of the message, the meeting seemed about to close without a positive step taken. Carey touched Fuller's arm and asked, "Is there nothing again to be done, sir?" Samuel Pierce Carey gives a sense of Fuller's decisive importance. He writes, "Once Fuller threw his inspired strength into the cause with Carey, things changed and men yielded. Carey alone was merely an enthusiast, a man with a bee in his bonnet. Him they could elude, but Carey and Fuller could not be ignored. When Fuller pleaded for the reopening of the shelved business, they could not refuse him. He took the kingdom by violence. Under his assistance, even at that 12th hour, they repented and turned their faces toward the light." In October of 1792, the association meeting was held at Kettering, and the society was given official form. The first collection, which amounted to just over 13 pounds in commitments, was collected in Andrew Fuller's snuff box. Samuel Pierce Carey, in his biography of Carey, labors to make this seem more appropriate by pointing out that the snuff box was engraved with a scene depicting Paul's conversion. Well, whatever S.P. Carey may have felt about the snuff box, its owner never relinquished the primary leadership role in England until he died. Fuller's fitness for the task had already been demonstrated. While Carey was still an impoverished pastor and shoemaker at Moulton, he would carry his production of shoes to sell to Thomas Gotch, a deacon in Fuller's church in Kettering. When Fuller learned of this, he suggested Gotch pay Carey a stipend without requiring the production of shoes, a service that Gotch was willing to perform. From the time of the formation of the BMS, a great part of Fuller's time and strength was spent in raising funds for the mission in India. Ryland would write of his friend's administrative efforts. With regard to Mr. Fuller's active concern for the welfare of the Baptist mission, from his appointment as secretary at its first formation till his death, it is impossible to do full justice to his indefatigable zeal, his assiduous attention to whatever could promote its welfare, and the uncommon prudence with which he conducted all measures that related to it at home and gave counsel to those that most needed it abroad. Fuller's travels took him all over the British Isles. He mentioned visits to Lancashire, Yorkshire, Norfolk, Essex, west of England and Wales. He went to Ireland and five times to Scotland in 1799, 1802, 1805, 1808, and 1813. In the beginning, he was often rejected. Ryland wrote that in London he was so troubled by the indifference of those he called on that he found it necessary to seek out back lanes where he could weep without drawing attention to himself. Ryland wrote, he never pressed and urged cases on those that were reluctant, but simply told an unvarnished tale and left it to conscience to dictate whether it deserved assistance. He didn't limit himself to Baptists. Ryland told the story of Fuller's contact with one man of another denomination. He writes, on one occasion, I remember a gentleman told him that if it had been a case of personal distress, he would help a Baptist as well as another man. But he did not think it consistent to aid our spreading the gospel abroad, as we should doubtless spread our own peculiar ideas of baptism with it. Well, sir, said he, Fuller, I have such a case in my pocket and can assure you that it is a good one, but I do not wish you to do what your conscience would restrict you from doing. The gentleman gave to this more private case. The next time Mr. Fuller came to town, he saw the same gentleman again and applied to another in his presence on behalf of the mission, but said nothing to him on the subject. Well, said he, Mr. Fuller, you do not ask me this time. No, sir, said Mr. F. You told me you did not think it your duty. True, said the gentleman. Perhaps my conscience is now better informed. Fuller's fundraising was an extension of his theology. In the end, the results were of the Lord, and since he was confident in the Lord, he could say, only let us have faith, and we shall not want money. Fuller's role was not limited to fundraising. He provided guidance for the society operations at home and the mission in India. He wrote to the missionaries on a regular basis to encourage and at times correct. He lent his pastor's ear during the early difficult years when Carey struggled with insufficient financial support, severe family difficulties, and discouragement over the lack of visible fruit. The message Fuller had preached as Carey and Thomas departed was a source of encouragement. In January of 1794, during a period of discouragement, Carey wrote in his journal, this morning at Calcutta, again disappointed about money, was much dejected and grieved, advised with Munshie, who is my trusty friend, but can find no settled plan. In the evening, had much relief in reading over Mr. Fuller's charge to us at Leicester. The affection there manifested almost overcame my spirits, for I have not been accustomed to sympathy of late. In July of 1799, Carey wrote from Madnabati in response to an encouraging letter from Fuller, "The success of the gospel, and among other things, the hitherto inextinguishable missionary flame in England and all the Western world gives us no little encouragement and animates our hearts. I wish we could warm yours with good tidings in return." On another occasion, he wrote, "You very encouragingly tell us not to faint if we see no fruits yet. I hope and trust we shall not, and hope you will also be kept from discouragement on our accounts. I feel very much lest the friends of religion should faint at our want of success." A letter Fuller wrote to John Thomas in May of 1796 gives a sense of his pastoral voice. He wrote, "My very dear brother, I have read yours to Brother Pierce. Oh, what feelings does it excite! How could I weep on your account? And nay, before I write any more, I will go aside and weep and pray for you to him who alone can deliver your soul from death and keep your feet from falling. My dear brother, it has afforded me some consolation while pleading with God on your behalf that his help could fly swifter than this letter. Oh, that before this arrives, you may be delivered from the horrible pit." Fuller went on to share a story of his own struggles, and he wrote, "Shall I tell you of my, tell you a little of my own experience? At one period of my life, I had a severe domestic trial. My heart melted under it like wax. I cried much to the Lord, and he delivered me out of my affliction." Then he went on to offer practical advice in overcoming the spiritual trial that Thomas was enduring. Fuller also interacted with the Indian converts. His letter to Krishna Powell reflects the joy felt by the society's supporters in England. From Leicester, he wrote on the 19th of August, 1801, "Dearly loved in the Lord, the joy of our hearts was great when the news of your conversion reached us. In you we see the first fruits of Hindustan, the travail of our Redeemer's soul, and a rich return for our imperfect labors to which the love of Christ constrained us. Now we beseech you, stand fast in the Lord. To unite with the church below is to be akin to that which is above. Satan divides men from God and one another." And I think this letter is very important in the context of the struggle that the Serampore mission waged against the whole issue of caste. He says, the gospel makes us one. You were once darkness, but now are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. Put off all that is evil. Put on Christ's new man. Abhor every kind of idolatry. Lay your account with persecutions. This was the master's lot and must be yours. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation. Let your chaste and holy conversation, your uprightness and gentleness, your firm adherence to the truth continue to refresh us. Pray and strive for the salvation of your fellow countrymen. Recommend to them the gospel by your long suffering and love. Andrew Fuller. Fuller did more than encourage. He often provided guidance and at times correction. He wrote to John Fountain in the strongest terms, insisting he not write back to England expressing political opinions which were dangerous to the cause since the British censors read their mail. Fuller even objected to some of Carey's initiatives. Carey spent a considerable amount of effort translating the Ramayana, a classical Hindu work. Fuller could see no value in it and referred to it as that piece of lumber. To William Ward, a member of the Serampore Trio, Fuller wrote an extended exposition, which we heard this morning, of his views on open communion. Originally, the church at Serampore practiced closed communion. However, Ward was disturbed by the fact that godly men of other denominations who were supportive of the mission were excluded from the Lord's Supper when they visited. John Ryland differed as well, and for a time, Serampore's policy became open communion. Under Fuller's guidance, they eventually returned to their closed position. Fuller's conduct in this process was a model of clear theological exposition, coupled with a generous spirit that helped keep the differences of opinion from affecting the working relationship between the missionaries or with Ryland on the home committee. While providing advice and guidance, Fuller was clear that he did not see his role as that of dictating to those on the field. His respect for Carey and the difficulties in communicating expeditiously with India made a policy of advisement more appropriate. As the BMS grew and more included Baptist leaders from outside the original men linked to the Northamptonshire Association, Fuller sensed a different attitude coming to the fore. He was especially reluctant to allow the increased influence of certain leaders from London, and he did all he could to retard their progress. At times, he was openly critical of their desire that the BMS employ leaders that were respectable in the eyes of society, and he resisted a push to have the BMS run primarily on business principles. He also defended the independency of the Serampore mission and its leaders, writing, "We do not consider ourselves as legislators for our brethren, but merely as co-workers with them. If ever the committee began to legislate for India, I should expect they would issue a declaration of independence, and I should not be sorry if they did. We have never pretended to govern them for two reasons. One is we think them better able to govern themselves than we are to govern them. Another is that they are at too great a distance to wait for our directions. Our business has been little more than to furnish them as far as we are able with men and furnish them with recruits." And I would just quibble with Fuller. He did much more than what he says in this letter, but he did maintain that policy of respect for the decision-making process that was being that occurred in Serampore. In the end, the London faction gained control of the BMS after Fuller died in 1815. The result was the Serampore controversy that did enormous damage to the society and to the Serampore mission. And the disastrous consequences of the mismanagement of the society after Fuller's death provide sad confirmation of the importance of Fuller's leadership as founding secretary. Vigorous defense. In 1813, when the question of the legalization of missionary work was before the British Parliament, a former resident of India by the name of Pendergast spread the story that William Carey had harangued the Indians and insulted their religion while standing on a tub in the streets of Calcutta. According to Pendergast, the situation had spun out of control, and Carey had to be rescued by the police. Nothing of the sort had occurred, and Fuller wrote Pendergast demanding a retraction. According to John Clark Marshman's account, Mr. Pendergast was more disposed to meet this demand by a challenge than by a retraction. He came up to Mr. Wilberforce in the house and asked him in a manner which in a noted duelist could not be mistaken, "Pray, do you know a Mr. Andrew Fuller, who has written to desire me to retract the statement which I made with regard to Dr. Carey?" Mr. Wilberforce answered with a smile that he knew him perfectly, "But depend on it, you will make nothing of him in your way. He is a respectable Baptist minister at Kettering." In defense of William Carey and the Serampore mission, Fuller was willing to go toe-to-toe with the most powerful commercial interest of Anglo-India. For example, in a letter to Edward Perry, Esquire, chairman of the East India Company, Fuller attacked charges published by Thomas Twining, a member of the Twining family that had made its fortune trading tea. Fuller joined the fray, throwing roundhouse punches. He prefaced his response with two quotations that made his position clear. The first from Nehemiah read, "There are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them in thy own heart." And the second consisted of Gamaliel's famous words to the effect that if the work be of the Lord, it would not be overthrown by its opponents. Fuller referred to a letter from Twining about the supposed danger of interfering with the religious views of the inhabitants of India. Fuller dismantles Twining's argument piece by piece. He objects to Twining's ambiguous use of the word interference, since it purposely insinuated the missionaries advocated the conversion of Hindus and Muslims by force. Fuller then confronted a problem that faces us today, the misappropriation of the idea of tolerance. He quoted Twining, who had written, "As long as we continue to govern India in the mild and tolerant spirit of Christianity, we may govern it with ease. But if ever the fatal day shall arise when religious innovation shall set her foot in that country, indignation will spread from one end of Hindustan to the other. Fuller asked, is giving the scriptures then to the natives in their own languages and offering to instruct them in their leading doctrines opposed to the mild and tolerant spirit of Christianity? If it be, sir, neither the founder of the Christian religion nor his followers have yet understood it. Fuller again quoted the tea magnate, Mr. Twining hopes our native subjects in India will be permitted quietly to follow their own religious opinions. We hope so too. But if this gentleman's wishes could be realized, we should not be permitted to follow ours, nor to recommend what we believe to be of eternal importance to our fellow men and fellow subjects. Fuller then continues his onslaught. The question Mr. Twining proposes to submit to a general court of proprietors, whatever be the terms in which it may be couched, will not be whether the natives of India shall continue to enjoy the most perfect toleration, but whether that toleration shall be extended to Christian missionaries. Fuller then attacked the Orwellian use of language on the part of the opponents of true Christianity. I have observed with pain, sir, of late years, a notion of toleration entertained even by some who would be thought its firmest advocates, which tends not only to abridge but to subvert it. They have no objection to Christians of any denomination enjoying their own opinions, and it may be their own worship, but they must not be allowed to make proselytes. Such appear to be the notions of Mr. Twining and his friends. They do not propose to persecute the Christians of India, provided they would keep their Christianity to themselves. But those who attempt to convert others are to be exterminated. Sir, I need not say to you that this is not toleration, but persecution. Toleration is a legal permission not only to enjoy our own principles unmolested, but to make use of all the fair means of persuasion to recommend them to others. Fuller then went for the knockout blow by quoting a recent letter from Carey in India. Carey had written, India swarms with deists, and deists are, in my opinion, the most intolerant of mankind. Their great desire is to exterminate true religion from the earth. I consider the alarms which have been spread through India as the fabrications of these men. Considering the force of Fuller's defense, it is no wonder that men like Pendergast were reduced to issuing challenges to duel. As a young man, Fuller had been a wrestler. At this point, he was long past physical engagement, but he was not shy to enter the ring of public opinion in defense of the missionary enterprise. An ardent struggle. In the sermon titled God's Approbation of Our Labors Necessary to the Hope of Success, Fuller had compared the missionary enterprise to Israel's conquest of the Promised Land. As we saw earlier, he spoke about the importance of the use of means, making the point that all that was achieved had been by the dint of the sword. As the title indicates, he also laid heavy emphasis on the priority of God in any successful effort. In addition, he emphasized the duty incumbent on followers of Christ in terms that might have been taken as a description of his own efforts. The promise was not accomplished at last, but by means of ardent, deadly, and persevering struggles. And such must be the efforts of the Church of Christ ere she will gain the victory over the spiritual wickedness with which she has to contend. He then compared the naysayers of his day with those of the biblical period. The Canaanites would not give up anything but at the point of the sword. Hence, the faint-hearted, the indolent, the weak in faith were for compromising matters with them. The same spirit which magnified difficulties at a distance, which spoke of cities as great and walled up to heaven, and of the sons of Anak being there, was for stopping short when they had gained footing in the land and for making leagues with the residue of the people. Thus it has long been in the Christian church, the gospel having obtained a footing in the Western nations, we have acted as though we were willing that Satan should enjoy the other parts without molestation. further then reiterated the charge of indolence and linked it to the failure to employ means. Every heathen and Mohammedan country has seemed to be a city walled up to heaven, and the inhabitants terrible as the sons of Anak. And even in our native country, an evangelical ministry having obtained a kind of establishment in some places, we have long acted as if we thought the rest were to be given up by consent and left to perish without any means being used for their salvation. Fuller went on to emphasize the imperative force of the Great Commission in terms that recall Carey's treatment in the inquiry. If God means to save any of them, it seems, he must bring them under the gospel or the gospel in some miraculous manner to them, whereas the command of the Savior is that we go and preach to every creature. He continued by emphasizing the great sacrifice of those who carried the gospel forward in the first generations of the Christian era. He wrote, "It was by ardent and persevering struggles that the gospel was introduced into the various nations, cities, and towns where it now is, and in many instances at the expense of life. Thousands of lives were sacrificed to this great object in the times of the apostles, and were I to say millions in succeeding ages, I would probably be within the compass of truth." Fuller himself set the standard in terms of commitment to the missionary cause, even though the stress was enormous and took a toll on his health. In 1794, early in the history of the BMS, he wrote, "My labors, however, in this harvest, I have reason to think, brought on a paralytic stroke, by which in January 1793, for a week or two, lost the use of one side of my face. That was recovered in a little time, but it left behind a headache, which I have reason to think will never fully leave me. I have ever since been incapable of reading or writing with intense application. At this time, I am much better than I was last year, but even now, reading or writing for a few hours will bring on the headache. Upon the whole, however, I feel satisfied. It was in service of God. If a man loses his limbs or his health by intemperance, it is to his dishonor. But not so if he lose them in serving his country. Paul was desirous of dying to the Lord. So let me." Fuller recognized that he was not the only one who suffered because of his efforts. In October of 1794, he wrote, "Of late, I have been greatly employed in journeying and preaching and endeavoring to collect for the East India Mission. I find a frequent removal from place to place, though good for my health, not good for my soul. I feel weary of journeys on account of their interfering so much with my work at home. I long to visit my congregation that I may know of their spiritual concerns and be able to preach to their cases." Fuller also knew that the strain placed on him was not greater than that borne by his friend in India. In March of 1797, Carey had written from Mundabati and unburdened his soul to Fuller. "To say anything of my own personal exercises would only be filling up paper with a long, tedious tale about myself. I therefore decline and only say that I have daily cause to complain, yet complain in reality but little, and am what I have been for many years, that poor, sluggish, phlegmatic creature who made all advantage of godly society to set the springs in motion, yet have lost little of that. My family trials, of which you intimate, you have heard, continue and increase. Some attempts on my life have been made, but I hope nothing of that kind is to be feared now. God has graciously preserved me and given me support, that I have not been remarkable retarded in my public work thereby. I am sorely distressed to see my dear children before the greatest indiscretions and most shocking expressions of saga are constantly uttered, and who are constantly taught to hate their father. 'Tis true they don't regard what is said, yet is insensibly impressed on their minds with a kind of British ferocity and viciousness which is to me very distressing." The stresses in Andrew Fuller's life were great, but they were no greater than those of his friend William Carey. So Fuller wrote and preached and traveled on behalf of the Baptist Missionary Society. He labored incessantly from the society's founding in 1792 until his death in 1815. His life was a fulfillment of another phrase from the sermon on God's approbation. If ever God prosper us in any great degree, it will be in the exercise of that spirit by which the martyrs obtained a good report. At one point in his ministry, his wife reportedly said, "You are killing yourself." Fuller answered, "Yes, but I can do no other. The hands that held the rope were never loosened except by death."
Well, we have a time for a few questions before we conclude our conference.
I will defer all the difficult questions to Ryan. I really don't know about that. I've come at Fuller through the lens of Carey, and so I think there were. I should probably defer to Dr. Morden or someone on that. I think it's interesting, many of the churches paid a heavy price. Carey's church at Leicester was very reluctant to let him go, and there's interesting letters after he left about the pain it had caused them, and yet their understanding that it was God's will. So I think that the churches, as well as the missionaries and the pastors involved, paid a price as part of missions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Morden.